And I talked a bit about how ritual and devotion is a way of engaging with the depths of the mind. So if we speak a number of different languages, different aspects of ourselves speak different languages. So we can speak the language of reason. But some of the deeper aspects of ourselves speak the language of ritual, of myth, of symbol. So if we're going to convert them to the Dharma, get them engaged with the Dharma, then we need to talk to them in a language that they relate to, that they understand. And then last week, we again went back to the mandala, and this time we invoked Amitabha, the Buddha of great love, the Buddha of the lotus family. And I talked a bit about how all the time we're kind of creating worlds for ourselves to live in out of very simple sense data. Each of us builds up a world. We pick out aspects of all this experience that's coming in, and we interpret it in different ways, and a lot of the time in relation to our own kind of, I call an ego project. Some things are supportive, or we feel that they're going to make us more secure. Some things feel a bit threatening, but a lot of our experience just doesn't really relate to that, and so that feels a bit neutral and a bit indifferent. So we're all creating worlds to live in all the time. And with ritual, it's as if we deliberately create a world, and we create a much more ideal world. We give ourselves a sense of the world that we could be living in much more of the time. And I also talked a little bit about offerings. Offerings as expressions of openness, expressions of gratitude, gratitude for having found the Dharma, gratitude for the fact that there have been human beings like us who have transformed themselves into fountains of love and compassion, and who've taken the time and trouble to tell other people about it, and for all that to be handed down over the centuries, so that we can all sit here this evening and we're not starting from scratch, it's kind of scratching our heads trying to work out what life is about and how to live it and what to do about our mental states and all that. We have so much to draw on, both examples and methods and teachings. So being aware of that, there's a sense of gratitude and appreciation. I also talked briefly about different kinds of offerings. You can have different kinds of aesthetics with offerings. They can be very, very simple. You can just offer one flower. And that can embody all your feeling for the three jewels. Or you can imaginatively offer endless flowers and everything that's ever been valuable and ever is valuable, whatever you can conceive of, vast arrays of jewels and whatever you're into, the best cars, the best computers, the best clothes, the best living environment, just everything, So, and both of those ways of offering have their advantages. There's something very beautiful about just the simplicity of very, very simple offerings, and just imbuing those very, very simple things with tremendous meaning and richness. But then there's also a benefit in really letting your mind become very expansive and rich and feeling like there's no limits, you know, on a physical level, you know, there are limits to how much you can offer, both because of the depths of our pockets and also the amount of energy that we have. You know, we can offer a whole lot of night lights, but that may not do it. But in imagination, we can just offer whatever we want. And from a Buddhist point of view, a mental action is an action. It has karmic effects. So when we have the desire, you know, that if we were Zarg, ruler of the universe, we couldn't think of anything better to do with all those kind of galaxies that we owned than to just sort of lay them all at the feet of the Buddha. So when we do that, that has quite a strong karmic effect. So there are advantages to both kinds of aesthetic, the very simple and the very rich. And we're fortunate if we can really relate to both of them at different times. It's not as if one is right and one is wrong. It's like sometimes people get into kind of debates or arguments about, you know, the simplicity and beauty of Zen versus all the richness of Tibetan Buddhism, say. But as Western Buddhists, we just draw on the whole tradition, so we can appreciate all those different ways of offering all those different aesthetics. So this week we might explore a bit more some of the aspects of devotion, some of the aspects of puja, just briefly. But I'd like to start with some meditation. Starting just with a couple of minutes of nothing at all, just open space. So giving our mind and body a holiday, nothing to do, just experiencing what's there. Now let's be aware of our connection with the earth, our connection with the ground. being aware that we're touching the earth. We can imagine our awareness, our energy, going down below the body, as if we're putting down roots. From that stable base, we let the body rise up. Open and spacious. Just taking a little time to be aware of what's happening in the body. And doing our best to let the awareness that we bring to the body be a kindly, open, receptive awareness. and letting that receptive awareness open out. Out beyond this room until we come to a circle of lotuses. Soft open petals. Maybe we see them. Maybe we have a felt sense that they're there. Being aware of their qualities. These soft open lotuses protect this place and protect our mind. And beyond the lotuses, it's a wall of vajras, diamond thunderbolts. Feeling into their qualities. And these diamond thunderbolts protect this place, protect our mind. Beyond the diamond thunderbolts, it's a ring of wisdom flames, burning, dancing. these wisdom flames. Protect this place. Protect our mind. And the three circles create the boundary of a mandala, a protected space of deep transformation. A space in which we can contact our deepest potential as human beings. We're seated together, practicing together, within this mandala, and right at its heart are the qualities of awakening, the qualities of enlightenment. Particularly appearing in the form of the Buddha Amitabha, infinite light. The Buddha of great love, great compassion. So we can allow ourselves to feel, to sense, to see maybe all the qualities of love and wisdom, freedom, energy, peace, all right here. In the heart of the mandala, and if we want, we can see them all embodied in the Buddha Amitabha, his body made of red light, seated in meditation. His body gives off light, gives off love. So if there's warm red light bathing the whole mandala, so we are bathed in love. If we relax and allow ourselves to feel the security of being within the mandala, being in the presence of the Buddha, of Amitabha, then it's as if there's an alive, dynamic exchange of energy between us and the Buddha. We're not just imagining an image. There's something going on which can really affect us. So if we really are in the presence of a great deal of love and compassion, there's a live exchange of energy. And allow ourselves to take in more of that loving energy, and in response, maybe we'd like to imagine giving something to the Buddha. Can be very simple, can be very rich and complex, whatever feels right. So as we come to the end of the meditation, there's no need to imagine anything disappearing. We're still seated within the mandala. And still have a sense of the qualities of enlightenment right here, Amitabha right here. And having made different offerings, some of them complex, some of them simple, let's end with something extremely simple. Let's imagine that all our expressions of openness and gratitude join together. So all our practice, it's part of one practice. Let's just invest one small thing with all that richness. So as the meditation comes to an end, like Tejasiddhi, to offer one night light on behalf of all of us to the Buddha. We can just have a sense that that one light combines all our offerings all our aspirations. And that one small light offered to the Buddha of infinite light can express all our appreciation, our openness, our gratitude for the fact that there can be love in the world and the light of the Dharma. think what we'll do is we'll have an earlier break than we usually do. We'll have 20 minutes as usual. And we'll give ourselves a bit more time to do things. After the break, we'll make more offerings, but of a different kind. So we'll start again at 20 to 9. When we create a mandala, it's as if we're creating a kind of timeless space, a space, I don't know, I sort of can have the feeling that you go out through that door into more kind of everyday tea break space, and then you come back here and it's like the Buddha is still sitting here, and it's almost like it's always here. Some strange way. And as the Buddha represents our deepest potential, ritual kind of helps us become attuned to our deepest potential. It helps us become attuned to the qualities that are waiting to be unfolded in all of us. And one of the ways in which we work with that is, well, in imagination we put ourselves into different positions, really. In the first half, we put ourselves in the position of being in the presence of the Buddha Amitabha. And if we manage to enter into that on a good day with a following wind, you feel yourself in contact with qualities of love and awareness that you can't usually access. And one of the main ritual expressions that we have is puja, is say like sevenfold puja. And in a way, in a sevenfold puja, what we're doing is we're kind of imaginatively being encouraged to put ourselves in the position of someone who is just completely open to the Buddha, completely open to the Dharma. It's like the words of the puja are the words that you would speak if you were completely open to the qualities of enlightenment, of awakening. Sometimes the words get in the way because, say, like with the sevenfold puja, you know, those words were produced by Shantideva, you know, who was somebody who was completely open to love and wisdom and so on. But he expressed that in his way, you know, sort of over 1,000 years ago. So sometimes those words don't quite do it for us. But in a way, we can't afford to let the words get in the way. What's important is that we just get into the spirit of it, the sort of devotional mood that those words are expressing. And the whole situation and those words of the puja, they help us to kind of imaginatively attune ourselves to... We put ourselves through the experience of someone who is deeply open to enlightenment, and that then produces more of that in ourselves. We contact more of those qualities of openness and receptivity and devotion and so on. So this course isn't particularly about our sevenfold puja. But it's worth just reflecting on some of those stages that we go through when we do the sevenfold puja, and just see how, starting from right from the beginning, because in a way the puja doesn't start with the offerings, the puja starts with feeling in the presence of the Buddha. If you don't do that, then it's kind of pointless, you know. It's like kind of giving a gift to someone who isn't there. It doesn't really do it, does it? So the puja starts with a sense of being in the presence of wisdom, of love, of complete freedom, completely liberated energy, and so on. And then, yeah, we make offerings, which are expressions of openness, gratitude, appreciation. And after that, there's the salutation, which can be physical. But the main thing, in a way, as I've said last week, is that there's an appreciation for the fact that I'm not the highest thing in the universe. Heaven help the universe if I am. So it's the fact that there is more to awareness, more to consciousness. We put ourselves in a kind of right relationship to things, rather than having a mandala that's kind of got us, you know, seated right on the shrine. You know, I am the most important thing in the entire world. We can try doing that. Anybody want to try doing that? It won't feel right, believe me. It won't quite feel as if that's how things should be. Yeah. On a deep level, it won't work. In fact, in all the dukkha, all the frustration and unsatisfactoriness that we experience in life is when, in effect, we kind of put ourselves right in the middle of the mandala. So, yeah, when we don't do that, and we put complete freedom at the centre of the mandala, or truth at the centre of the mandala, or great love and compassion at the centre of the mandala, then the whole thing works. So our salutation is putting ourselves in the right kind of relationship to that, and to understand, or to understand, we have to kind of stand under. We have to have a sense that there's something more fulfilling, yeah, that there's the possibility of wisdom, of being far wiser, of being far more creative, and so on. And then we go for refuge, seeing the value of the Buddha. We go for refuge, which is both a commitment. It's no good just sitting here thinking, oh, the Buddha is absolutely wonderful, but, you know, little old me, I'm completely useless. Oh, but the Buddha is so wonderful. Yes, that devotion is very nice, but we have to have a sense that, and I can become more like that. So our going for refuge is an expression of trust in the Dharma. The Dharma says that all human beings have the capacity to become wise and free and creative and loving. Even us. So it's an expression of that faith and a commitment that we'll follow that path. But it's also an entrusting of ourselves. If we want to see it in those terms, talking in terms of commitment, it feels like I've got to do it all. And often you can then feel like little old limited me has to do it all. When actually there are deeper forces in us than we recognise. And to some extent the path can also be seen in terms of just letting go and allowing those deeper forces to come into play. So we can make our best efforts, but we can also entrust ourselves to the Dharma, entrust our lives to the Dharma. And that works better than me sitting in the centre of the mandala. And then there's confession. We do things, you know, in sometimes just in one moment of anger we say something, and almost as it's coming out of our mouths we're thinking, no, I shouldn't have said that, but we have, and it's there, and that moment can never be undone. What's done is done. But the relationship that we have to what we've done makes a huge difference. Our attitude towards things that we've done where we feel we've let ourselves down or we've hurt ourselves or other people, well, that attitude is profoundly important. It's as if we're moment by moment sort of shaping our lives. So our attitude to the past and to what's been done also helps to shape our lives. And through confession, we, in a way, separate ourselves from, it's almost like we start to take energy out of those things that we've done, that are faults and failings. We don't identify with them. We no longer, it's like we may have said something really sort of cutting to somebody and thought, well, that was a really clever thing to say at the time, or we may have been really pleased that we cut them down to size or whatever. At that moment, that was just us. We were just doing what we wanted to do. But then later on, as we get more sensitive, we realise, no, that wasn't helpful, that wasn't kind, that wasn't empathetic, it wasn't considerate. So rather than just being identified with it and feeling, yes, I'm pleased I did that, there's a pulling away, there's a drawing of energy out of that situation. So we gradually kind of withdraw energy, firstly from being identified, and eventually even from sort of shame and guilt connected with what we've done. Until eventually we just get to a point where, okay, that was something we did. And we've confessed it, we've let it go. And the final stage of confession is that you, as it were, draw a line under it. You don't keep on and on and on feeling badly and feeling badly and feeling badly. That doesn't help you or anybody else. So at that point, when we've seen into the nature of what we've done, we've realised that wasn't helpful, we're no longer putting energy into that tendency, and we confess, we let go eventually of any shame, any guilt connected with it, and then it's just a fact, it's just part of our life, but there's no longer energy going into that situation anyway. And that's where we kind of aim to end up with confession. And that comes again out of, if we're in the position of being in the presence of the Buddha, there's a kind of an inevitable comparison between their mental states and our mental states. And also, that great desire, that great sort of pull to be more like that. And that pull makes us aware of all the things which stop us being more like that. So confession is a way of just clearing the path in a way, just clearing the ground so that we can be more like that. Okay. let's do a bit more practice. Yeah, I think what I'd like to invite you to do is, it's not exactly confession, but it's connected with one thing which tends to hold us all back, which is our attachment to our attachment to people, so that we don't fully appreciate them for themselves, or because we're attached to them, we don't fully allow them to live their lives sort of freely. It's like, you know, I have a good friend and they tell me very happily that they're going to leave Cambridge and they're going to go off and live somewhere else, and they're really pleased about it. And part of me is really pleased for them, but part of me thinks, but they're going to leave. They're not going to be around anymore. So something in me doesn't like that very much. And that, yeah, that attachment doesn't do them any good, because I don't fully kind of see them, you know, see what's really going to make them happy and appreciate that and support that. And it doesn't do me any good, because I just end up going, oh, they're going to leave, I don't like it. That doesn't feel very good. So it's a bad thing all round, whichever way you look at it. I'd like to suggest we do a little ritual where we think of someone that we're attached to in some way. You can make this as strong or as light for yourself as you like. It could be someone you're a bit friends with, or it could be someone you're very close to. It could be a family member, say, or someone that you have very strong connections with. And as I said last week, you know, we imbue things with significance. So before the break, Tejas City offered a nightlight, and that kind of included all our offerings. It was all there, all being offered to the Buddha. But it's just a bit of wax, isn't it? There's the wick on it and some foil. But with the power of mind, this can have all kinds of significance. It's not anything in itself. In a way, it's up to us whether we give it deep meaning or we think, oh, it's just a nightlight. What I'd invite you to do at a certain point that I'll tell you about is to just allow a nightlight to symbolise this person that you're a bit attached to, or quite attached to, and we're just going to offer a nightlight to the Buddha, to Amitabha. But in doing that, there's a sense that we're acknowledging that this person has their own life, their own karma, their own qualities, their own creativity, and we're doing our best just to, rather than holding on to them, we're just going to let them be free. We're just going to let them be living a life entrusted to the Dharma. We're entrusting them to the Dharma. We're entrusting them to the Buddha. So rather than having ourselves at the centre of the mandala, and what I really want is my friend not to leave Cambridge, thank you very much, because I won't see them, we kind of get out of the way of that. And we just think, well, okay, actually, life is king. I can't control everything. So let's put the Buddha at the centre of the mandala and just entrust that this person. May their life go well. May everything happen in the best possible way. Do you get the idea? Yeah? Okay. So what we'll do is we'll just sit for a couple of minutes, and then we'll make sure that we're really back. If we feel we've left the mandala, that we're really back in it, really with Amitabha, and then I'll cue Tejaswini in, and she'll start leading the Amitabha mantra. And while that's going on, in your own time, but a few of you at once, so we're not too late, and just come forward, and if you want to, just offer a night light with that sense that if you were, to the extent that you're holding on to that person, seeing them just as somebody who's fulfills a particular role in your life, okay, you acknowledge, yes, that's what you feel, you're not denying that, but finally we want them to be free, and finally we want them to be, if you like, within the sphere of influence of the forces of love and compassion. So we'll just offer a light with that sense. So let's start just again. Few moments quiet just to experience ourselves. And just checking that we're grounded, earthed, connected. And that we're in a posture that supports sense of awareness. Noticing the quality of our awareness. It's relaxed or tense, bright or dull. Kindly or judgmental. Just seeing if it would like to become more open, softer, reminding ourselves that we're still within the mandala. Still protected by all the qualities of the lotus, the vajra, and the wisdom flames. We're still practicing together, supporting one another. Our practice helps everyone else. Everyone's practice helps ours. Right at the heart of the mandala, is Amitabha. It's all the qualities of awakening. Completely loving awareness that never falters, is totally reliable, that's always in touch with the deep truth of how things are. That's completely available to us and to all life. That loving influence bathing the whole of the mandala. And that loving influence can dissolve our attachment. Our tendency to distort things and confuse things by clinging on. All the love and understanding of the Buddha is gently supporting us to let go, to relax, to not try and control, to let life be king. Let's bring to mind someone whom we'd like to not cling on to, whose life we'd like to entrust to all the positive forces embodied in the Buddha. Let's chant the mantra as a further support. And while that's going on, we can offer a night light as a symbol of letting that person be free, letting go of our attachment.
Om Mami Devahri.
Devari. Om Mami Devari.
Devari, Devari,
O Mami. Swami Devahri.
Oh, my.
For a minute, let's just relax and rejoice in what we've done and what all those who've made an offering have done. Before we finish, I'd appreciate it if just for a minute, while we're in this mandala with Amitabha, we could just wish well two people who died at the weekend, two Dharmacharinis. One from New Zealand called Navachitar, who came on a visit, got a viral infection and died in London, and she was an Amitabha practitioner. And Vajragita from Holland, again a long-standing Dharmacharini, who is a Padmasambhava practitioner. Just really wish them well. Thank you.